Newsweek redefines masculinity. The courts take on gay rights. Women take over the Swiss government. A church apologizes for doing its job. And a debate over urinary segregation. It's Thursday, September 23, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The cover story of this week's Newsweek magazine is very striking, as is the photograph on the cover, showing a shirtless man holding a little boy with the little boy's face looking at the reader. The headline screams, "Man up!" The traditional male is an endangered species. The magazine declares, "It's time to rethink masculinity." Now, this article follows, of course, on the cover story in the Atlantic Monthly earlier this year, in which Hannah Rosen spoke of the end of men. Man Up is an article by two men in this case, arguing for a revision, a rather radical revision, of the notion of masculinity. Andrew Romano and Tony DuCoppel are writing that masculinity has to follow a new script. In a changing world, men are simply going to have to change, and masculinity is going to have to change with them. Now, they offer some interesting statistics. They go back to the latest recession, indicating that the largest number of jobs were lost in sectors of the economy traditionally dominated by men. They look to the future, where an increasing number of jobs, the big job opportunities of the future, are likely to be in sectors that had traditionally been dedicated to women. In this case, the next 10 years is likely to see the need for 500,000 additional school teachers and almost 600,000 new nurses. Newsweek says that men, as they look to the future, are simply going to have to take on girly jobs, that's their word, and learn how to change diapers. Now, a news story like this is always more than a news story. In this case, Newsweek is editorializing more than it's reporting, though it does report some very interesting statistics. 6 out of 10 college students are women. The largest number of students at every level of higher education are female. The troubling aspects of the life of boys these days is seen in their failure in school and their failure to grow up and take on the roles and responsibilities traditionally associated with manhood. Now comes Newsweek magazine to say that the answer is going to require a redefinition of masculinity. Gone are going to be the older stereotypes. They identify, for instance, the Marlboro man. And in the place of the Marlboro man is going to come the nurturing father, the man who's equally at home changing diapers as changing the tire. I respond to Newsweek's cover story in my article published today entitled "Man Up or Man Down? Newsweek Redefines Masculinity." I point out in the article that Newsweek goes after several predictable stereotypes, and it also, predictably, goes towards an affirmation of social egalitarianism when it comes to gender distinction, and it looks even to the welfare state, for instance in Sweden, with liberal parental leave policies and all the rest, as evidence of the fact that men and women are, after all, not that different, and the future is in a world, well, that leads to men and women being virtually interchangeable, at least in the workplace and increasingly in the home. Now, as much as that might trouble us, there's one section of the Newsweek article that's really interesting. I read, "The truth is, it's not just how men style themselves that will make them whole again. It's what they do with their days. The riggers, welders, and boilermakers of generations past weren't wearing overalls to feel like men, as Susan Faludi, the author of books on both sexes, has pointed out. Instead, their sense of their own manhood flowed out of their utility in a society, not the other way around." That's a very interesting paragraph, and one that, frankly, packs a very profound punch. Manhood is not about dressing, like we're dressing up as men. It's not about doing the kinds of things that send a signal to the culture that we're men. It's about men doing what men do. Our fathers got up in the morning, went to work early, worked hard all day, made their way to ball games and PTA meetings and all the rest, got the work done at home, and then went to bed and got up the next day and did it all over again. The reality is that in every generation, men prove what manhood is all about by getting the job done. And if the world is changing around us, it's just going to change the way that job's going to be done. It doesn't change, essentially, what it means to be a man. A society has to honor and encourage and frankly channel young men into being husbands and fathers, citizens and workers, employees and friends, in order for that civilization to survive. You know, the most haunting aspect of this news story, of the cover story Newsweek magazine, is not so much the essay, but the cover on the front, that little boy looking at the reader. Even though the article largely ignores him, the question that haunts me is what kind of manhood he will know in the future. John Schmartz, writing at the New York Times, is out with a very interesting article on why the federal courts have taken on the gay rights issue now with such a velocity, especially over the last several years. He says this, quoting Erwin Chemerinsky, the law school dean at the University of California at Irvine, and I quote, "Federal judges are no longer persuaded that a moral condemnation of homosexuality justifies government discrimination," end quote. This assumption that a moral condemnation of homosexuality is basically legally irrelevant is at the very core of Judge Von Walker's decision in the Proposition 8 trial in California. Where did he get that? Well, John Schwartz is exactly right. He got it back in 2003 when Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinion in the case Lawrence v. Texas, then before the U.S. Supreme Court. That decision basically struck down sodomy laws in all 50 states. The striking down of the sodomy laws was significant in and of itself, but what made that decision especially significant is where Justice Kennedy wrote about sexual orientation as a part of the essence of one's own individuality and personhood, and as an inviolable right, suggests that nothing that discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation can be allowable. Now, what's really, really interesting is another argument that is made in this article. That argument is made by Richard Epstein, a libertarian legal scholar at New York University. This is his statement. Quote, "There's just no way, once you start down that road, that you're going to get off of it. If you can't criminalize it, you can't discriminate against it," end quote. That is a fascinating argument. It's extremely helpful and insightful as we look at the contemporary legal debate over same-sex marriage and homosexuality. Professor Epstein says that the current opinion, the current principle of the courts is this: if you cannot criminalize it, you can't discriminate on that basis. Well, just imagine how that principle might look if it was applied to all aspects of our society. That's something I don't think we can live with. The Guardian, one of the most important papers in Britain, the left wing of the daily newspapers there in London, is reporting that in Switzerland, women, for the very first time, outnumber men in the Federal Council. Now, in Switzerland, the Federal Council is a 7-member body that is basically akin to the cabinet in the United States government. It is the executive body that makes most of the decisions about the operation of the Swiss government. For the very first time in history, women now outnumber men. Now, this means, for the very first time, that a European government is basically headed, in terms of the majority of its composition, by women. This is a massive social transformation. It is being quietly observed in Switzerland and in Europe. But, of course, as you look at this kind of hallmark issue, it's indicative of massive cultural and social changes that are taking place all around us. Now, the Washington Post is out with a very different kind of article, but it is very sympathetic to the same position. Connie Schultz, writing a review of the book Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women by Rebecca Traister, argues that it was indeed the 2008 election that will turn out to be a great watershed in terms of the feminist advance. Now, you might look at her argument and wonder how it could be so. After all, at least on the Democratic side of the equation, the two final candidates for the nomination of that party to be president of the United States were a woman and an African-American man, and the woman did not win. But Rebecca Traister argues, and now Connie Schultz comes back to affirm, the reality is that if you look at the 2008 election, not just in terms of the fact that it was the very first time that a woman made a serious run for her party's nomination, but as you look through all the races, gubernatorial, senatorial, congressional, and then down to local legislative and mayoral elections, 2008 turns out to be a massive watershed. I think the argument has some traction. Long term, I don't know if we will look back to the year 2008 as a turnkey election, one of those great transformative moments, but there is no doubt that something significant did take place there. Something very significant recently took place in St. Paul, Minnesota. It took place in the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, where the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, in terms of its local synod, met for a rite of reception for three lesbian ministers into that denomination. The Reverend Peter Rognes, Bishop of the ELCA St. Paul Synod, said before the event that it was going to be a massive signal to the society that this ceremony indicates the full inclusion of persons, regardless of sexual orientation, into the Lutheran ministry. Now, if you just go backwards, just a few months ago, to the recent meeting of the General Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, you'll find that it was there that the church made the decision, meeting in Minneapolis, to reverse the denomination's policy against openly gay persons serving on the clergy roster. Now, what makes this story particularly interesting to me is not just the reception of these three ministers, and most notably the Reverend Anita Hill, who's identified as a well-known minister in that area, but the rite of reception and the language that was used. As the reporter for the Star Tribune of Minneapolis reports, that is Joey McLeister, what made this rite of reception particularly interesting is that it was the church rather than an individual who was making the confession of sin. Listen to this. This is taken directly from the rite of reception. Quote, "We have fallen short in honoring all people of God and being an instrument for that grace. We have disciplined, censured, and expelled when we should have listened, learned, and included." That is really interesting language. Here you have a church apologizing for having exercised church discipline on the basis of Scripture. Here you have a church gathered together for a rite of reception in defiance of Scripture, inaugurating a rite of reception in which they confess the so-called sin of having acted in obedience to Scripture. You know, sometimes the world turns over and then seems to turn over again. The language we use in this kind of ceremony betrays what we really believe, and this betrays a horrible confusion. The Chronicle of Higher Education is out with a different kind of confusion in its reporting, and it's one of those things that has to be almost seen to be believed. They have two bloggers at the Chronicle of Higher Education who are debating an issue that heretofore I did not even know existed. That is the issue of urinary segregation. You wonder what we're talking about? Well, Laurie Essig, a professor at Middlebury College, posted an article at the Brainstorm column of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and that, by the way, is the Wall Street Journal, so to speak, of higher education in America, bemoaning the fact that in America and on many college campuses, there continues a pattern of urinary segregation. She writes that first it was colored and white bathrooms, now it is men and women, which is just too oppressive. It leads to urinary segregation, which is demeaning to people. It, after all, is a heterosexist imposition of gender distinctions that she says just doesn't fit modern society. In the name of the liberation of all humanity, she calls for unisex bathrooms, an end to urinary segregation. Answering her is Diane Auer Jones, who writes that she wants men kept out of her bathroom. She sees it as a great civilizational achievement that there are men and women's bathrooms. She acknowledges that that might lead to some difficulty or confusion for transgender people, but she says don't get rid of the distinctions. If you have to do something, add a third distinction, whatever, or confused, or transgender, but let there be men and women in separate bathrooms. Male and female, urinary segregation. This kind of confusion betrays a great illness at the very basis of a civilization. A serious debate, even bannered back and forth in the pages of the Chronicle of Higher Education by academics on the issue of urinary segregation, is a sign that, well, things are not well in the ivory tower. But far beyond that, things are not well in many sectors beyond. This kind of argument is not isolated to the ivory tower. It may be found there in its classical form of argument, but in reality, this kind of confusion over gender is now driven through the society from top to bottom. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I hope you'll go to my website at albertmohler.com and find the article on Newsweek's cover story and a wealth of other resources at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I hope you'll attend the Give Me an Answer Collegiate Conference, which is going to take place February 11 through 12, 2011. It will be an incredible opportunity to gather with college students to consider some of the most pressing apologetic issues of the day. For more information, go to sbts.edu. I'll meet you tomorrow for the briefing.